You said last time that what we have now is corporatism, because corporatism was presented in the 20s and 30s like some kind of alternative between communism on the one hand and capitalism on the other hand. But you look at this a little bit differently, because you say corporatism, it sounded to me like you said a corporatism is part of current capitalism. Could you explain what corporatism is?
Well,
whether it is the same corporatism you mean as the fascist Mussolini corporatism?
Obviously, it's different because times are different. You know, the modes of transmission of information are completely different. The amount of it is different as well. Our current times see rather interesting fast developments to what's really taking place, for example, in Asia. You know, last year I was in China. After 21 years, I have been there. And what really amazed me is the degree of consolidation of corporate power and governmental power into this creation for a better world that is very neoliberal-like on the outside and very fascist-like on the inside. And those systems are simply able to coexist each other rather successfully, although they are inefficient in their own sense as far as the creating their own bubbles. Because as traditionally, our capitalism system kind of creates, kind of almost feeds off the cycle of destruction and growth, whether there's implosion of the bubble economy and there are a lot of different elements of products being and companies and what have you be bought on the cheap, where their value can grow again to another cycle where the destruction takes place again and what have you. Mm-hmm. What's different this time, I think, and I think comes from inspiration of the Chinese model, is that we see a little bit beyond development right now into the process of monopolization of the power, where the corporations are becoming so big and so intertwined into our everyday life, they're basically take over some parts of a life which were traditionally reserved not only for the commons, the quote-unquote public sphere, the citizenship, but also for the government. And I think the best example of that would be in the case of, for example, military mercenaries such as Blackwater, Z, and the latest reincarnations, because they seem to be morphing into a different entities all the time. Where
this is not well known or well covered here. So basically, Blackwater got huge contracts in Iraq to actually
Afghanistan
carry out the war, basically.
Exactly, yeah. And basically to provide a military force, so-called security force. Well,
the founder's sister is now Ministry of Education, I think.
Yeah, well, what's really interesting here is that in a traditional governmental versus NGO structure, you definitely have a framework of laws, not only domestic and national laws, but also international laws that actually regulate this type of activities, looking at even at Geneva Conventions, where the basic idea of combatant, non-combatant is being defined and who takes responsibility for occupied land, for the population, what have you. When you have this type of new actor coming into this public space that's well-armed, that has basically for all practical purposes the elements of the state power, military is one example, armaments, what have you, and none of the responsibilities and none of the liabilities, then you're talking about simply completely different set of references. It's almost like a medieval times where, the only way to exert any kind of quote-unquote authority over something like this is to have literally sometimes legal or even military engagement with this. And it's not only goes along the cases of our involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places. But for example, what's going on in Ukraine, which are covered extensively past several years. You have someone like Igor Kolomoisky, which is one of the major oligarchs in the Dnipropetrovsk region of Ukraine, basically paying for 10,000 people strong, well-equipped division by his own money. Mm-hmm. Or you have a situation where Eric Prince, who used to own Blackwater and these four reincarnations, going to Chinese government and stating that they're able to provide a solution to their situation in the western part of China, where there are a lot of refugees and fightings coming out of Burma. Since the Chinese government is not able to effectively deal with the situation, they able to provide a solution.
So you say that Eric Prince, so the former owner of Blackwater and the brother of Betsy DeVos,
yes,
that
together with the Chinese,
that he is doing business now with the Chinese.
Well, he attempted to as far as several months ago. Yes, he was actually in Beijing and dealing with high level officials in
that's
China
very
as well.
Interesting.
So in a way,
so that's why we get to the point that's corporatism, but in the sense that public functions or public, so services, let's call them services, that used to be carried out by states are privatized.
Yes, and in the official version to, in its own, presentation to the public was that they are more cost efficient and they're more efficient as far as which is actually not true. I mean, there are a variety of different studies done that independent think tanks that actually proved that, for example, in the United States, Social Security system has been probably one of the world's longest, most successful systems of managing public money as far as the overall cost is concerned, less than 3%.
But as far as war is concerned, it's maybe a different story, especially in democracies, because, of course, not that many Americans got killed in Afghanistan so far, also because of that privatization. And the technology.
Yes, but on the other hand, we have 22 veterans every day killing themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and this war is still ongoing domestically in their heads, and they are real tangible victims of this process of our militarization of our spaces, not only necessarily in the military field, but also as private spheres as well. So this is, it's almost like looking at the symptoms of the disease by limiting only in its scope what it really causes, but without really looking at the deeper perspective on the whole variety of different aspects of our lives and how they're being affected. And
another example, maybe, let me know if I'm correct. So is this week we had the news that, on the one hand, like billions were shipped abroad to Dubai, I think. And on the other, at the same time, the minister, but on a local level from Antwerp for social affairs, he decided that he would go after people who were frauding with their the city money payments, like support. But he wouldn't do it. He would ask private companies to do it.
Yeah, well, I think in the US we call it cover your ass syndrome, which basically, I think everyone in position of power within a democratic system, nominally democratic system, if they're working quite a bit of a long time, they're realizing what they can do and what they cannot do within the system itself by getting themselves in trouble. So they will most likely would go after a very long-hanging fruit, since obviously going after big picture items or big ticket items would cause a lot of animosity within any kind of political setup. They go after the low-hanging fruit to the degree where they're able to create a system of pretending to do something.
Yeah,
but
that's definitely one part of the of the thing. But the other thing that was interesting, I thought, was that it was going to be a private company. It was not the city people, administration, who are going to chase those people. It's actually they're going to source it out, to outsource it to a private company.
Yeah.
So that's is that part of the corporatization?
It is
corporatism.
Because neoliberalism creates this almost ideology-like inkling to stating whatever private it's good, whatever public it's wrong. So idea is just simply, I don't necessarily believe that a lot of people really believe it from a practical standpoint, because obviously empirical data and statistical data, a case-by-case basis, when it comes to education, medical care, constantly shows what's private is actually more expensive, less cost-efficient than private would, the public would be. But that said, they simply, it's in any kind of political setup, there is a kind of moving forward trend where if you not with us, you're against us. And a lot of people in position of power, whether it's municipal or state or federal government, they're looking, while being part of the organization, they also looking for their own particular private interests as well. And obviously asking difficult questions or stating somewhere where actually it's not correct to overall trend, who make some kind of promise for them later on as far as their own career development is concerned. So that's why I think neoliberal system of economic thinking as well as the political thinking is genius in its way. It's like almost water and air that fuels the corporatism to the degree where it's very difficult to pinpoint exactly what the issue really is. However, if you look at a long-term perspective approach to the developments on the ground, let's say destruction of our public sphere, destruction of our environment, then you see definitely results from this. However, it is so dispersed and so simply like invisible on a minuscule level that it's very difficult for an individual to look at this objectively and say, well, this is to blame, that is to blame. It's almost like the environment that kind of creates this. A corporatism feeds on that. This is basically, in China is a really good example of this, where the country can automatically, economically progress, do provide much better standards of living for its people, but it's leaving the, you know, but the system itself gives a middle finger to the democracy, stating that, well, the capitalism in our current version doesn't need democracy anymore. Mm-hmm. It's actually post-democratic. And we are actually sort of like going to this new uncharted territory where not only corporatism...
But then maybe you say, as far as China is concerned, is maybe more related to the Confucianists or Confucianism and the 2,000 or 3,000 year history in that respect than with capitalism?
A lot of people, you know, I spend a lot of time in Japan.
Or it's a mix of both.
I see somewhat very different parallels to Chinese situation as well, although countries are quite a bit different in their own makeup. But I think the issue here is there's always given as an excuse for a variety of different moves that would basically customize the version of corporatism into the more of a local, you know, neoliberal outcome of this. You know, you can also criticize Russia in some certain aspects because Russia is also a very neoliberal state as far as economics is concerned. But what's really taking place here is sort of a migration into system, into something that it's ultimately kind of becomes a entity in itself that's kind of feeds on itself. And it thinks about itself and in regards everything else as a quote-unquote externalities, such as good medical care, good education, environmental degradation. That's basically externality that can be basically outsourced to somebody else's responsibility. And in this case, the people who are picking up the tab are regular citizens, you and taxpayers, you and me, while the system goes on and seems like it's completely disengaged. But it's a false premise because ultimately... If we continue on this track, everything will collapse.
Is it changing significantly since Trump? Because you've been very critical about Obama.
Yeah.
Even today you were already.
Yes.
So is there really a difference? Because what we see is that a social democracy in Europe, which is a bit like the Democrats in the US, they're falling apart basically because they've been corrupted by power in the past and they've been just participated in the system. So now in the US, you got someone else who isn't social democrat or democrat. So,
well,
is it similar or is it? His style definitely is different.
From a historical standpoint, I think.
But I have the impression, as far as environment, for example, that there is a big difference. Obama wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
But Trump is just.
Well, from a historical standpoint, historical standpoint, I think it's a really interesting subject because. The first time and last time in our national history that we had a real demagogue in power was Andrew Jackson, 1820s. This is the guy who was behind a quote-unquote, Trail of Tears, where he basically expelled our Indian native population west of Mississippi to what can be categorized as a de facto death march. This was the real beginning of our called the Drachnach Westen, go west, was repeated by Adolf Hitler in, 1939 going, Drachnach Osten.
Okay. So Andrew Jackson is the president who Donald Trump has identified as his great hero.
Exactly.
He has portraits of Jackson hanging in the Oval Office now.
I remember mentioning his name, but he's quite unknown here, of course.
He's on a $20 bill, by the way. You can if you have a $20 bill, you can see him as well.
But if you think about genocide in America, ethnic cleansing, there.
Yeah.
It's, of course, a rogues gallery. It's a large cast.
So if they digitalize all the money, having the $20 bill disappear would be one good...
But also, interesting thing about Jackson itself is that he was also a most prominent figure in fight against Bank of the United States. So he was also almost identical degree of proto-fascist demagogue to also... have a very extensive critique of capitalism, well, colonial capitalism, I would say plantation capitalism, existing in this age. So there are definitely parallels to his times. Trump, you know, is an interesting character. First of all, he comes from a world of media, although he's a self-made businessman. I had a bit of a rude awakening last July, when I watched the first. It's the only first debate I watched between Clinton and Trump. And after this, and I had a conversation with my friends and my wife, and I said that Trump will win the election because Trump was so well skilled to push the buttons that simply resonated the American public to the degree where Yale-educated Clinton, who at one time was called the best lawyer west of Mississippi, she was actually called that, simply would miss. And I think you have to understand the way our political elites work. They live in silos and bubbles of New York, Washington, Los Angeles. And they simply do not have any kind of emotional as well as intellectual connection to what really life is with, quote unquote, the rest of the country itself. Mm-hmm. What they often call, you know, I live in Chicago and we are often called, pejoratively called, the flyover country. So we just, it's not a country you pay attention to, you just fly over it.
Right.
So, and this is really a predominant situation that brought Trump to power, plus a complete and utter collaboration with the media, because mm-hmm. media has created Trump to the degree where he was, I recently read some article somewhere, I think it was Daily Beast, stating that he got an equivalent of $1.5 billion worth of media coverage, more than anybody else. And, you know, and Trump obviously is very good for the media business. You know, after years of decline, New York Times has
In spite of the shouting and screaming to CNN.
Exactly.
Yeah, CNN, yeah.
So everyone who often says, you know, people are laughing at Trump, and I think we can say somebody's laughing all the way to the bank, because definitely mm-hmm. you can see the benefit from this type of setup coming on the political scene and making all this trouble. Yeah. That said, Trump is an interesting figure because in a way he's a sort of a almost like a, I would say, proto-fascistic creature of continuous adolescence, although he's in 70 plus years now. And he's been constantly told to listen to the grown-ups in the room. And who are the grown-ups? NSA, CIA, mm-hmm. Pentagon. Yeah. So,
and three or four generals.
Exactly. So in a way, it causes a very sort of a very interesting, weird dynamic on the right itself, where they want to live to this ideal of a Tea Party type of movement-inspired rebelliousness, where the less government is supposed to be good, the further financialization of our society is supposed to be better, that system that quintessentially we could call the American dream is supposed to make everybody rich and prosperous, mm-hmm. despite all the facts and all the statistics, they actually come opposite of that. But what's really happening on our national scale, you have this sort of a kind of retrenching from the public life into this sort of like a silos-like mentality, and it's happening with the American left as well, where basically the idea is just to fight, resist. Mm. Well, maybe in some ways it can be achievable on a local level, but I think generally with so many different issues that kind of are turning our country apart, which I think Trump itself is a symptom of, not really a disease, a symptom. Mm-hmm. This might create further division within the country and rather negative long-term consequences. The only thing I'm worrying about, specifically looking from a media perspective...
Let me just check one thing. Derek Monroe. So the last question was, and you actually started answering it, I think, is really... how does it look? Because it's pretty grim.
Thing I'm worrying about...
Because on the other hand, there is resistance in the US. You got, like the Bernie Sanders type of mm-hmm. people in the UK and et cetera, et cetera. So...
Well, definitely is a consolidated push to sort of produce a unified opposition to the current status quo in Washington, namely to take the power back, which kind of resonates with the right idea of making America great again or taking their country back. The only thing I'm worried from my experience as a journalist covering international issues as well as geopolitical stratification of our society is that there might be a point of our political journey as a country where we will feel again it's good to be united again, And the best catalyst for unification would be war. And this is something which I'm sorry to say this, with the current situation progressing in Eastern Europe. I just got back from Poland, and I have heard really interesting stories about our troops being deployed there, what's being shipped, what's not being shipped, what's being officially declared.
So more than North Korea, Eastern Europe is the issue?
Yes. I think this is really something that's really kind of brewing up to be next battlefield. And this continent has already suffered enough in the past 100 years or more of war stratification, and you know all the consequences of many people playing, you know, war games on its territory. And I'm truly afraid that there would be a repeat of scenario where, for our own domestic purposes and domestic benefit, we will play this scenario again against Russia, for example.
So no saving from people rejecting the populist rights by the left end. So we say they're just going to start another war and create support by...
From the American perspective, I don't have great insight into the European left, but from the American perspective, left is completely divided and corrupt. Not necessarily by its own...
But when you say left, it's like the social democracy and the central left.
Social democratic system has completely collapsed to the degree of not able to be compatible with the realities of our economic and geopolitical life, just generally in the West. So I think we are currently living in the times of anti-system, it's post-democratic. Definitely, the democracy as we know traditionally, it's gone. And this is basically sort of like a purgatory of political expectations. You know, I wouldn't say we will be entering hell. Maybe this purgatory will extend for a longer period of time. But there's definitely a formulation of new political power, of perhaps corporatism getting together into this new form of this facade-like democracy, and to create something that actually works for it the best and doesn't work for the whole population. And some of the aspects are actually being explored. I just spoke with Michael yesterday. It's the idea of this basic income, which in itself, on a surface, sounds very attractive, very egalitarian, but what's connected with it, it's absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that's, I think, that we are just sort of in really uncharted territory as we speak.
Okay. Unfortunately, we have to leave it here.